As Governor Abbott prepares for a statewide televised address on the blackouts, many wonder why they haven't heard more from him before now. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Rapid fallout from the blackout of 2021 already happening as five ERCOT board members say they'll tender their resignations. We'll have the latest. Also, more on the implications of last week's blackout in the fight against COVID-19. Could last week's disaster actually lead to changes in labor laws? A labor historian on what history tells us about past patterns in Texas. Plus, commentator W.F. Strong rethinks his list of Texas-themed tunes, a PolitiFact check of Beto O'Rourke, and much more when the Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 24th day of February 2021, and the fallout from the blackout was inevitable. But it seems to be happening already. Item number one, five members of the Board of Directors of the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, are set to resign today, and a sixth has withdrawn his application to the board. A notable asterisk to this development, none of the board members live in Texas, missing out on the personal effects of rolling outages that didn't roll, leaving more than 4.5 million actual residents of the Lone Star State in the dark and cold. Also worth noting, the vacancies will not immediately be filled. A suggestion that the entity today known as ERCOT might not look quite the same for much longer. Item number two, local governments are getting ready to flex their own muscles. Some officials in Houston exploring getting off the ERCOT grid altogether and finding an alternative source for power. Also, Travis County's district attorney says his office will be conducting an investigation of its own. This is especially noteworthy since much of ERCOT's business with the state is conducted in the state capital city, and since Austin is the Travis County seat, it would be a logical jurisdiction for criminal charges to be brought. Not that any have been brought yet. Item number three, Governor Greg Abbott is set to make a televised address to the state at 6 p.m. Central. And as Brett Jaspers of KERA reports, there are plenty of Texans wondering why they haven't heard more from the governor before now.
Desiree Humphrey's home in Fort Worth lost power for multiple stretches, each lasting almost 20 hours. She got only short reprieves of a couple of hours, and when she did, she called her electric company.
This is not a rolling blackout. Why am I not getting electricity? I have pets and I have a 71-year-old mother and we're cold, we're hungry, and we have no heat.
Humphreys wasn't alone. Millions in Texas lost power for days. Governor Greg Abbott did a statewide press conference the Saturday before the storm, but then went 3 days without one.
You know, I didn't see him but maybe once or twice on Facebook. And I definitely didn't see him on any of my news sources.
On Monday morning, President's Day, millions of people like Humphreys didn't know what was happening. Dan Woodfin of the electric grid manager ERCOT spoke to reporters, but didn't say how long the outages would last.
It depends on the transmission owner. They're the ones that are really in control of that.
People sought information from their power companies, who said ERCOT required them to shut off power. Governor Abbott gave interviews with local television stations, but Abbott's most high-profile media appearance was on Sean Hannity's show on the Fox News Channel last Tuesday night.
Sean, this shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America.
In that interview, Abbott chose to misleadingly blame renewable energy for the power outages. He's been widely criticized for the appearance. George Haddow was a senior official at the Federal Emergency Management Agency during the Clinton administration. He's now at Tulane University.
People are not concerned about, you know, renewable energy or anything else. What they want to do is, how are you helping me? What's going on? What's happening? Why are my lights out? When are they coming back on? All these things. I mean, people are not interested in his political agenda.
Haddow says a leader's main goal through a disaster, start to finish, is to give people timely and accurate information through many platforms. Abbott's personal Twitter account did give some updates in those early days of the crisis. The Texas Division of Emergency Management's social media accounts also posted links to a map of warming centers and warned people about road conditions and carbon monoxide poisoning. But many people don't use social media, and a televised news briefing is a huge megaphone. George Haddow.
I don't know why the governor would not choose to be on TV in the morning in the mid-afternoon and at night every day of this event. Why not? There's information to be given.
A spokesperson for Governor Abbott didn't immediately respond to an email seeking an interview. When Abbott began regular press conferences on Wednesday the 17th, he walked back his blame of renewable energy. His tone was different and the information vital.
Cold temperatures will remain across much of the state for the next few days. Most of the state will be below freezing tomorrow morning.
Early on in disasters, there can be a lack of information to deliver, but updates still have value, according to Chris Jones, Senior VP at Pierrepont Communications.
It is a good quality in a crisis leader to tell you what I know, but I'm not going to speculate what we don't know, and I'm not going to promise you a solution before we have one. That's just sort of a basic principle of crisis communications.
For her part, Desiree Humphreys of Fort Worth doesn't blame Governor Abbott for the state's response to the winter storm. She says he did his best with what he had, but his best could have been better.
They just need to make the public a little bit more aware and come back and say, hey, you know, we don't have anything yet, but we're still working on it, folks. Don't just leave us all out in the cold.
She says at one point she felt like no one was there. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Now, Jaspers heard from Governor Abbott spokesperson Renee Easy this morning. She says the governor maintained a robust media presence through interviews on local television.
Monday, he started doing interviews around 3 o'clock and kept going through into the 6 o'clock hour, hitting Dallas, Austin, Midland, San Antonio, Houston, just kind of across the state, and then continued that on Tuesday during the noon hour, and then again during 5 and 6. So, I mean, he continued to have a statewide presence throughout this.
That's the voice of Abbott spokesperson Renee Easy. The governor will address the state at 6 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. in El Paso and Hudspeth counties. Texas has been experiencing a sharp decline in COVID-19 cases this month, but will there be an uptick after last week's winter storm put many Texans in positions where they had to stay with family and friends after losing water, power, and more? Of course, traveling to the grocery stores and other crowded places to find relief almost certainly would seem to add to the dangers. Can we expect a major setback? Here to help us with some of these questions, Dr. James McDivitt. He's Senior Vice President and Dean of Clinical Affairs at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. McDivitt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get back to that assertion that I made about a sharp decline in COVID-19 cases this month. That's what I've been hearing sort of peripherally as we've been trying to deal with the blackout situation. Where do we stand with cases and hospitalizations?
Yeah, we've seen a very dramatic drop really since towards the end of January, where when you look at the total new cases, at least in the Houston area, we're about a third of where we were at the peak. And now we're still much higher than we want to be. Our community case rate is still pretty high, but it's dropped really, really dramatically, which is a really good sign. And hospitalizations lag, but they're also dropping as well. And also encouraging, we're seeing that same trend really pretty broadly across the country.
What accounts for that decline? The New York Times was suggesting that, nearly 5% of Texans have been vaccinated with two doses. Is that having an impact?
I think it's a little bit surprising that it's dropping as quickly as it is. And I would emphasize that this is not reason to become complacent, because we still have the potential dangerous variants out there. We still have to mask, still have to distance, still have to stay out of crowded indoor spaces, et cetera, et cetera. That's not over. But I suspect a few things are going on. I think we are starting to see vaccinations have an impact, and that impact isn't going to be like a light switch going off where we wake up one morning and COVID-19 is gone. It's going to feel more like a dimmer switch gradually turning it down. I think we have to keep in mind that a lot of COVID-19 infection has been asymptomatic, so there are people out in the community that had the disease that are immune that never knew they had it. And I think coming off this recent huge and scary surge, it probably got enough people's attention that we're doing a better job of masking and distancing. So those three things combined, I think, are helping to drive the numbers down.
Well, let's fast forward now to some questions that are likely on a lot of Texans' minds right now after last week's winter storm. As a result of what happened, do you anticipate an uptick in cases, hospitalizations, and perhaps even deaths from COVID-19?
Well, there's the good news and bad news. The good news is I actually don't think so. And there are a couple reasons why. Every time we've had an event where we've aggregated people for whatever reason, whether it was the Super Bowl or the December holidays, we've always sort of rung the alarm bells appropriately in advance to be careful, and we don't want to create another surge or super spreader event. We never really saw those events come to fruition, and we never saw a big surge after those aggregation events. When you look at what happened with the horrible storm, yes, we had people aggregate. We had people that had to leave their homes and go into other homes. We had people that that were congregated indoors. On the other hand, the entire state shut down. So we didn't have people going to work or school or businesses or restaurants or bars. I think the impact of that shutdown is going to way overshadow the impact of people coming together and aggregating. So I have very little concern we're going to see a post-storm surge from that reason. Now, a couple other factors. Some vaccine programs got slowed down. Testing wasn't available, so we may see a little bit of a spike because testing didn't happen or results got delayed during the storm. But I think that spike's going to be artificial. I don't think it's going to be real. I think it'll be a testing impact that we'll see.
I know a lot of people are concerned about the vaccine rollout. Do you think that that's going to be severely affected?
I don't think so. I think it's a blip. We'll catch up. And we're vaccinating at such a rapid rate right now that I think it'll be a rounding error.
In the few seconds that we have left, want to venture any sense of when this pandemic might largely subside?
My guess is, I'm fairly confident, and this is a guess, like everybody else has a guess, I'm fairly confident we'll start to get back to normal by the fall. I sort of expect that we're going to ramp up vaccinations, and we're racing against variants, so we need to vaccinate as quickly as possible. With all the vaccine that's starting to flood our markets, I think there's a realistic possibility we could see things substantially improve by the summertime.
Dr. James McDivitt is Senior Vice President and Dean of Clinical Affairs at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. McDivitt, thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our own Michael Marks in for social media editor Wells Dunbar on this Wednesday. Michael, what are you hearing?
David, that report by Brett Jaspers on Governor Greg Abbott's response to last week's blackouts, folks are talking about that. Don't have to look far on social media to find people who are displeased with the governor's response, as well as, you know, sort of the political climate that helped produce it. Got quite a few examples, but we do want to hear from Texans about what they want or about the governor's response to the storm.
Indeed.
I'll be looking for them.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Art Can, a program of the Texas Cultural Trust and Houston Endowment, whose 2021 State of the Arts report finds Texas employs nearly 900,000 innovation workers. More at ArtCanTexas.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the wake of last week's catastrophe, we've been hearing remarkable stories like this one from a Northeast Austin senior living community. After losing power, water, and access to food, residents had to rely on a rescue by local volunteers. Sangeeta Menon of KUT Austin reports on what happened after one of the center's residents reached out for help.
The St. George's apartment complex has 68 elderly residents. Lisa, she didn't want to use her last name, has lived there for 12 years. She says after the power went out last week, some residents tried to warm themselves with the light from small candles. The situation got bad quickly.
It was pretty scary because we've got people here on oxygen. We had people that had a need for a breathing a nebulizer treatment and CPAPs, you know, all of that. None of it was available.
When the power returned, people still didn't have water, and residents who rely on grocery deliveries from HEB and Walmart were running out of food when those stores had to cancel. Lisa says she prayed on what to do and decided she would reach out on the social media platform Nextdoor, which she recently joined, to let neighbors know the senior community needed food and water. That post caught the eye of Branston Cyphers. He's the president of the Coronado Hills and Creekside Neighborhood Association, which includes the senior complex. He reached out to Lisa and visited the complex.
They all didn't have any water. They couldn't boil water because a lot of them were in wheelchairs, a lot of them on walkers. and they can't drive. They're immobile, you know, and, you know, a lot of them couldn't even lift the water out of their car, even if they were to go get it.
Cypher's first step was to get water. He went to a distribution event hosted by Powered by People, an organization that coordinates volunteer efforts in Texas. Cypher's explained the situation, and a volunteer coordinator got more than 20 people to deliver cases of water door-to-door to the senior residents. At the same time, neighbors and church volunteers who had seen Cypher's call for help on social media delivered canned foods, hot meals, and fresh groceries to the complex. By late Sunday morning, Lisa said there was a, quote, army of angels dropping off supplies to her apartment, which was used as a staging area, while Cypher's visited each apartment asking what people needed. Volunteers brought more than 100 cases of water, much more than the 15 cases Lisa had originally hoped to get.
It felt really good to see the community kind of step up and volunteers kind of willingly show up and give up their time and resources to help out people that they don't even know.
Cypher says he was happy Lisa had said something or the local community wouldn't have known to help. Lisa says her role was insignificant.
I was so blessed to be able to do that. That's all I can say. Am I exhausted? Absolutely. Is half the city exhausted? Absolutely. But it just was overwhelming goodness and blessings.
She says thanks to those blessings, no one at the complex went to bed thirsty. I'm Sangeeta Menon in Austin.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. During this past snow and ice storm, most people could not work. If you work from home, you probably couldn't because you had no power and no internet access. If you leave your home to go to work, you were probably stuck at home with impassable roads and you couldn't work anyway because there was no power at your place of work. Does any of this sound familiar? Okay, well then let's fast forward to how you marked your time. Vacation? Sick days? What might our experiences add up to when it comes to protections for workers? Perhaps the past can give us some hints. Tom Alter teaches history at Texas State University. He specializes in issues of labor, race, capitalism, and populism. And in the spirit of full disclosure, he'd like you to know he's a member of a union himself. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me, and I hope everyone's doing better this week after the horrible week last week.
Indeed. One natural disaster does not always lead to labor improvements, however, but when it comes to disasters, have you noted anything in the course of history that suggests that there can be implications or repercussions for labor?
Yes, there have been a few natural disasters that have affected politics in Texas and sometimes changes. For example, you had the flood of 1913 help make the issue of farm tenancy and the ability of tenant farmers to be able to buy land the main issue of Texas politics. You had in 1910, the percentage of Texas farmers that were tenants were 52%. And the Texas Socialist Party was basically the only organization advocating for tenant farmers. You had the fall of 1913. A large rainstorm hit central Texas on December 5th, 1913, and the Brazos River near Waco overflowed, and further south, both the Brazos and Colorados overflowed, joining into a single river around 100. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, and of course, not all disasters that Texas has faced or will face are natural ones. There are also those that are man-made. The Texas City explosion comes to mind, for example.
Yes, in 1947, when you had a French ship that was full of ammonium nitrate that caught fire and then exploded, and that resulted in, around 581 people died, 5,000 injured, and 500 homes were destroyed. But out of that, there was a number of changes, and Texas City became a port only for oil. And the disaster brought changes in chemical manufacturing and new regulations for the bagging, handling, and shipping of chemicals.
And these have direct result on conditions for workers, too.
Correct, yes, because the workers are the ones in these refineries that are faced with these conditions. They're the ones that are going to be most adversely affected by any disaster that happens. And also, they live in the communities that are affected.
There is a something else, though, that we should probably talk a bit about, because if you were to look at, say, a list of changes to labor laws, quite often what you see on that list are actions by workers, whether they are strikes or walkouts or worker-led boycotts. In Texas, of course, unions have not been strong, historically speaking. And I'm curious if what we see here in Texas is a kind of pattern of disaster leading to change.
Hopefully so. And that begins with creating strong unions, because like I said, it's the workers that are facing the conditions. And if you have a employer or a boss that's like cutting corners by, for example, refusing to live up to OSHA safety standards, or in the case of last week, not winterizing equipment, if you're an ununionized worker, you're going to be fearful of speaking out against that. But if you have a strong union, you're going to have a be in a better position to speak up and advocate for not only your rights, but also the rights of the community to be protected from these natural disasters.
Professor, as we look at the events of last week, do you foresee any real potential for change? And what sort of change might occur when it comes to protections for labor as a result of the disaster and the outages?
Yes, I do foresee the possibility of change. You have a large number of people that are rightly upset about what happened last week. You can see people calling for more regulations of the energy industry to prevent future disasters. And then you have bigger projects, such as things like the Green New Deal, which would diversify the energy that's used by Texas, or even further reforms like putting full government ownership of public utilities so that they're run solely in the interest of providing the needs for the people instead of just for corporate profits.
You believe that could happen in Texas?
Everything's possible. I mean, you get enough people angry and upset, and so hopefully we'll see what comes out of that, whether people's memories are short or long.
Thomas Alter teaches history and specializes in the history of labor at Texas State University. Professor, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Tomorrow, state lawmakers hold the first of what could be many hearings on winter storm blackouts. KUT's Mose Bouchel has more.
A lot of public attention and blame so far has gone to the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT. It's the group that ordered the blackouts to stop a catastrophic failure of the Texas grid. But ERCOT doesn't really have regulatory power, and it's just one of many groups responsible for Texas power generation and distribution. Here's Austin-based Democratic State Rep Donna Howard.
It really goes beyond that to looking at also the Public Utilities Commission, which oversees ERCOT, to looking at the Railroad Commission, which oversees gas production and the gas lines, to obviously looking internally at the legislature.
Howard serves on the House State Affairs Committee, one of the House committees holding the hearings on Thursday at 9 a.m. At the same time, the state Senate will hold its own hearings on the blackouts. Proposals to avoid further blackouts range from improving winterization of electricity infrastructure to a complete overhaul of the state's deregulated electricity market.
Mose Bouchel reporting. Environmental groups say Texas must do more to prepare for extreme weather after industrial facilities released an extra 3.5 million pounds of pollution into the air during last week's winter storm. Nearly 200 sites in 54 counties emitted toxic chemicals. Those facilities include oil refineries and petrochemical plants. Alina Kraft is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
One of the things that we've learned through these events is that facilities can and should be doing more to protect the infrastructure within their facility. They should be doing more to monitor around the fence line of their facilities.
Kraft adds the state needs to increase fines for polluters. Three mass vaccination sites operated by the federal government and local officials open in Texas today. One is located at Fair Park in Dallas. The Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins explains how many shots the is expected to administer.
They're going to be providing 3,000 first doses a day of Pfizer vaccine to these underserved communities for 3 weeks, and then 3,000 second shots a day for the underserved communities for an additional 3 weeks.
The other two FEMA mega vaccination sites are in Arlington and Houston. And a federal judge in Texas has indefinitely halted President Biden's plans for a 100-day moratorium on most deportations. Texas sought the preliminary injunction issued last night, arguing the moratorium broke federal law and posed financial harm to the state. I'm Joseph Leahy.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The number of people trying to cross the southwest border illegally has steadily increased during the pandemic. Stats from U.S. Customs and Border Protection show that in January alone, nearly 3,000 people a day were taken into custody. The vast majority were quickly expelled under Title 42. That's a Trump administration policy to prevent the spread of COVID-19. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports from El Paso, where more and more migrants are climbing over the border wall and suffering serious injuries.
People living along this stretch of border west of El Paso just have to look up to know this is a hotspot for smugglers moving migrants across the border. CBP helicopters fly overhead day and night. These teens peeking through the border fence from the Mexican side tell me they see a lot of people climbing over the barrier, many using ladders. That's despite the fact the Trump administration upgraded the barricade to a 30-foot-tall bollard-style structure. Two of the men who tried to scale the fence near El Paso in recent weeks and fell are now at a migrant shelter in the desolate Mexican border town, Palomas, nearly 100 miles away. They're recovering from serious injuries.
Me caí. Ahí terminó todo para mí.
Joan Jairo Ushka Alcocer, a 25-year-old man from Ecuador, says his dream of reaching the U.S. ended at the foot of the wall.
Traté de cruzar el muro, pero
Pedro Gomez, a 37-year-old man from Guatemala, tells me he slipped and toppled off the top of the fence. The men want their full names used so their account of events can be verified. They're among a growing number of desperate migrants climbing the border barrier with dangerous and sometimes deadly consequences. Gomez, a father of four, has casts on both legs and sits in a wheelchair. Ushka Alcocer lies on a bunk bed. Both say they told the Border Patrol agents who picked them up that they were injured and in pain. Gomez says he was crawling on his hands and knees when approached by Border Patrol agents, unable to walk. Ushka Alcocer says he told agents he couldn't move after his fall. Even so, both say they were returned quickly to Mexico without medical care. According to CBP, neither, quote, presented illness or injury during their brief encounters with agents. But Pastor Rosalio Sosa, who runs the migrant shelter where the injured men are recovering, says he's seen it happen numerous times.
And they don't have any medical attention, nothing. They just pick them up and send them over here. No wheelchairs, no nothing. Not even a Tylenol.
According to El Paso Border Patrol Chief Gloria Chavez, when it's apparent someone is hurt, agents administer first aid and request assistance if needed. That may include an agent trained as an emergency medical technician or an ambulance, depending on the severity of the injury. The higher border fence is part of an enforcement strategy designed to deter illegal crossings by making it more difficult and dangerous.
But this just hasn't happened.
Yeva Yusonite is author of the book Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border. She's worked as a paramedic and is a professor of international security and anthropology at Brown University.
The border infrastructure is getting deadlier, and people's reasons for moving are increasing as well. So it is just a bad combination.
That combination is resulting in more serious border wall injuries. Ruben Garcia is director of Annunciation House, an organization that provides temporary shelter for migrants and refugees in El Paso.
When I say serious injuries, I'm talking about
fractured legs in multiple places, fractured ankles, broken hips, pelvises. I'm talking about broken ribs, spinal injuries.
The injured migrants at Annunciation House were sent to the hospital first by Border Patrol, says Garcia. Most were women. Back near the border fence, after sunset, neighbors on both sides expect another busy night. Janet Lara lives in the U.S.
The border patrols are up and down, helicopters, so we're like, oh, it's normal to us, you know?
Her mobile home is on the last street near the border wall, where the dreams of migrants trying to reach the United States start and sometimes end. I'm Angela Cochergan, El Paso.
A class action lawsuit's being filed against Texas retail power provider Gritty after customers received sky-high bills after last week's storm. Dallas Morning News reports that the suit filed Monday in Houston alleges Gritty price-gouged customers while power was cut to many in the state. The lead plaintiff seeking more than $1 billion in financial relief for affected customers. Rural disconnects ongoing in parts of Texas. More on that story as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Incredible as it may sound, as of this morning, thousands of Hill Country residents are still without power, mainly in Gillespie and Kerr counties. They're served by a rural electric cooperative that's facing the challenge of restoring electricity to small numbers of people over huge areas. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan reports.
Some Hill Country residents have been without power for 10 days or more. The Central Texas Electric Cooperative General Manager, Bob Lott, says that what happened last week was the proverbial perfect storm.
8 days, sub-freezing temperatures, roads were closed, we had difficulty getting help in. We've got crews on the ground now, we started getting them on Saturday. We've got somewhere between 20 and probably closer to 25 crews out working now.
He says the CTEC crews are working from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, 7 days a week, to turn the lights back on for the 5,000 or so customers still without power. The CTEC region that was hit particularly hard was in southwestern Gillespie County and northeastern Kerr County.
There are stretches of line in multiple places where there are 10, 15, 20 poles in a row that are laid over on the ground. And when I say they're laid over on the ground, they're snapped off like matchsticks. They all need to be replaced, and that's not a fast process, even in the best of weather.
He's hoping that with the 20 to 25 crews CTEC is working, that those without power will be reduced by late next week to 1,000 people or less. Connie Gilbert and her husband Steve retired to Kerr County just last year.
We kind of built our dream home up there. We've really enjoyed living out there.
By Saturday the 13th, they had lost power. They kept a roaring fire going, but when the cold house became too much to bear, they headed to a hotel in Kerrville. But even that comfort didn't last long.
On the 15th, they lost power. And so we checked out of there on Tuesday the 16th and went and stayed with my daughter in New Braunfels.
Rolling power outages in New Braunfels were better than no power at all. Last Friday, Gilbert was able to get through to their electric provider, CTEC, to get the news they'd been waiting for.
She said, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Where y'all are located from where the substation is, she said it could take 4 weeks before we get to you.
But Lott is sure that it won't take that long to bring back power.
I would like to, by the end of next week, have it down to less than 500 or 1,000 members.
And by 500 or 1,000 members, he means members without power. He doesn't know where the Gilberts live, so he admits he can't be exact for them, though he's sure it will be soon.
But I can't overpromise and underdeliver.
Connie Gilbert feared the worst being so long without heat, but her worst fears about burst water lines at home didn't come to pass.
We've been out there and we don't see any leaks so far.
For now, they're borrowing an RV from a daughter and are looking for a generator to power it. Bob Lott doesn't think his crews can repair the lines any quicker than they are.
I mean, we're handing them a bag on the way out with breakfast and lunch in it. They're working all day. They come in at 10 o'clock at night, and we're feeding them and sending them to bed so they're ready to go the next morning again.
So for now, the Gilberts and hundreds of other customers will have to keep waiting. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Despite the misery that Texas has endured of late, its music serves as a reminder of much of what folks love about the Lone Star State. You may recall some time ago when commentator W.F. Strong waxed eloquent about songs dedicated to Texas towns. You know, Amarillo by Morning, Galveston, Streets of Laredo, and so on. But W.F. tells us that judging from the initial reaction, his list was not quite sufficient. Not when you consider the songs that take a more, shall we say, holistic view.
We must begin, I suppose, with our official state song, Texas, Our Texas, written in 1924 by William Marsh, a British immigrant from Liverpool. Another early classic would have to be Deep in the Heart of Texas, written in 1941 and first recorded by Perry Como, but probably the best-known version is this one by Gene Autry.
The cowboys cry, ki-yip-the-yi, deep in the heart of Texas. The dog is bald, and say you all, deep in the heart of Texas.
Just a few years later, Ernest Tubb gave us another classic that could have been used by the Texas Travel Bureau as their theme song. There's a little bit of everything in Texas. Here is Willie Nelson's 1993 cover.
There are 49 states around it, and each of them have treasures of their own. And everything they boast of, I sure found it. We've got them all right here at home.
In 1975, the Charlie Daniels Band released its Texas anthem, titled simply Texas, from the album Night Rider.
There's a place not too far away from here, out with the cows and the Lone Star beer, where they're living and loving, it's quite all right with me. What they call it, Texas, it's a mighty fine place to be.
Sometimes we show how much we love something by how much we miss it, by how much we long for it. Here's George Strait with Can't See Texas From Here from his 82 album, Straight From the Heart. And I believe it was.
So if you see me looking down, I'm trying not to show this frown, cause I can't see Texas from here.
Gary P. Nunn gave us London Homesick Blues, which is hard not to put on the list, but from the same 84 album, Home with the Armadillo, we get this one that's dead solid perfect.
Will you ask me what I like about Texas? It's a big timber around Nacogdoches, driving El Camino Real down to San Antonio.
Bet Gary hadn't had to pay for a belt buster or a blizzard for a long, long time. I first heard this next song by the British singer Chris Rea while driving across West Texas in 1989, appropriately under a big yellow moon on Highway 90 south of Van Horn, a road that goes on forever.
Warm winds blowing, heat and blue sky, and a road that goes forever.
And you certainly know this song, which has been ubiquitous since its release more than 25 years ago, believe it or not, by Little Texas.
Dance if you want to see heaven, brother, here's your chance. God bless Texas.
Number 9, Vince Gill sang I'll Take Texas in 1998, and his song did indeed take Texas by storm.
When it comes to making love under the stars above, well, honey, I'll take Texas every time.
And number 10, here's Miranda Lambert to wrap up our list appropriately with Texas Pride from 2001.
Well, they say there's lots of fans for them Texas country bands, playing all them songs about Texas pride.
That's my list. What's on yours? I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a professor of culture and communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can find his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org, in Texas Co-op Power Magazine, and wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, right here with a reminder that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential for early cancer detection. Doctors can suggest how to safely keep these appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Former Congressman Beto O'Rourke said that energy experts and State House Democrats had been warning about blackouts for years before Winter Storm Uri wreaked havoc on the Texas power grid. But is that a fact? Here to help separate fact from fiction, Brandon Mulder with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you, David.
So this claim appeared where else? Twitter. In a thread by O'Rourke himself. What's the full context here?
That's right. So in a Twitter thread where the former congressman and Senate candidate, he was taking some shots at Republican leaders and essentially blaming them for years of inaction. He said, quote, state leaders don't get to say that they didn't see this coming and that energy experts and state House Democrats were warning of this for years. And then he called out Governor Greg Abbott specifically, saying that he, quote, chose to ignore the facts.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit about how exactly experts were warning about this failure of the grid, according to O'Rourke.
Well, it looks like the earliest warning signs came in 1989. This was the last time temperatures got as cold as they did last week. And during that cold snap, electrical generators similarly failed. So the Public Utility Commission, which oversees the electric and water utilities, issued a number of recommendations aimed at improving winterization of electric plants, but it didn't make those recommendations mandatory. Then Texas went through another cold snap 10 years ago in 2011 when blackouts affected about 3.2 million homes. After that storm, federal regulators released a report that again identified winterization deficiencies. And now energy experts are saying that the deficiencies identified in the 2011 report are very similar to those that hampered the system last week.
All right. Well, those are the experts. What about the state Democrats part of O'Rourke's claim? What were they saying?
Well, Beto said that he was specifically referring to Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, a Democrat who was previously a state lawmaker. After the 2011 storm, Turner filed a bill that would have forced ERCOT to reserve enough power to prevent blackouts. That bill didn't make it very far, though. And then there were other bills favored by the Democratic caucus intended to improve energy infrastructure, including one that would have allowed ERCOT to get power from the Mexico grid. But all of those either failed to pass or remain pending. Now, to be fair, Republicans also filed bills to this effect. For instance, State Comptroller Glenn Hagar, who was a lawmaker back then as well, he passed a bill that required electric companies to report winterization efforts to the states. But of course, now he's questioning whether his bill went far enough.
Well, is there enough information already for you to make a ruling here?
Well, Beto said that state leaders had been warned about this, and he appears correct. Reports go all the way back to 1989 show winterization deficiencies among the grid's power generators, and then those same deficiencies were again highlighted in 2011 and here again last week. Furthermore, state Democrats were among those trying to pass bills to address grid issues, but not many of those bills made it very far. We rate this claim true.
True. PolitiFact's ruling on Beto O'Rourke's claim online that energy experts and House Democrats were warning of a Texas grid failure for years. Brandon Mulder is with PolitiFact Texas. Brandon, thanks.
Thank you, David.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Michael Marks is in for social media editor Wells Dunbar on this Wednesday. Michael, we just didn't have much time to chat there earlier in the broadcast. Get us caught up. What are folks talking about across the Lone Star State?
Sure thing. Sure thing, David. I'm ready for the music at any time. It can come up when you least expect it.
It'll just sneak up on you. That's right.
That's right. Well, didn't get to share any of the responses out there to our lead story. That's Governor Greg Abbott's response to the utility crises last week. You have a lot of folks who have a lot to say about that specifically, but also, you know, sort of the political climate that produced the state's current power system. A few examples here that I wanted to share. This one from Twitter user Dressage in Politics in Frisco, who tweets the hashtag Resign Abbott. We are in this mess because of you and your buddies who have voted against regulations to prevent this. Also, in reference to those ERCOT board resignations you referenced at the top of the show, David.
Right.
Wanted to share this from Robert Manigault in Houston, who tweets, it's not enough for ERCOT board members to resign. Governor Abbott should resign also. ERCOT did not design, build, or authorize the energy grid. Texas legislators did. And also, as we heard from Mose Bichelle earlier in the Texas Roundup, David, the Public Utility Commission of Texas also has some responsibility in this matter. Plenty of blame to go around in the eyes of Texans, David. We'll see what the governor has to say next in his speech tonight at 6 Central, 5 Mountain Time.
Yep. It's interesting because Governor Abbott is running for governor again, and he's got Beto O'Rourke. A lot of talk about him perhaps breathing down the governor's neck. Possible bit of his own. At least that's a lot of the speculation. Mm. He hasn't confirmed, but he has apparently not ruled it out either. So there's that political dynamic in the background.
That's right. I wanted to share one more here before we go, David. This one from Marcus in Dallas, who tweets at the governor. The grid in Texas was minutes away from complete failure. The state would have lost power for weeks or months. You knew of these issues and did nothing to prevent them. And I think that's a question that we're going to try and find answers to in the coming days, David. And that's who knew what when as far as the state of the grid and the incoming winter storm that resulted in its failure.
Yeah, and it's not just the lawmakers, you know, state lawmakers who are conducting investigations. As I was mentioning earlier, now you have the Travis County DA doing his own investigation. We're going to be hearing about this for some time to come. And it'll be interesting, too, to see. You know, people kind of get confused with ERCOT. ERCOT is not a regulatory body. It basically handles the distribution. That's the Public Utilities Commission. And so it's going to be interesting to see just exactly where all this ultimately shakes out. But it's going to be shaken out over the next several weeks and months. That's for sure.
No doubt, David. There's plenty more to discuss here, including Harris County looking at possibly removing themselves from ERCOT. I wonder if they will be the last municipality, the last place.
Jurisdiction,
That jurisdiction is the word I was looking for. There's that music.
Yeah, you hear it. Rhonda Fanning and Laura Rice are executive and managing producers. Michael Marks been in for social media producer Wells Dunbar today. You can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. And on behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you can join us again tomorrow.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Tejas Storytelling Festival, online March 11th through the 14th, featuring over 60 storytellers, sharing the magic and mystery of storytelling and music. Tickets available at TejasStorytelling.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.